We've been discussing the current concept of Emuna. We said that the concept of what we call in English belief, which is a translation of Emuna, doesn't really have an English translation. We're not going to go over the last 5 weeks in detail. But the pathway that we set for those who knew is that the Jewish approach to the subject of faith is that there's no blind leap like other systems sometimes describe. The Jewish pathway is that what one strives for is knowledge. After that, there's a special kind of work that's called Emunah, which we translate perhaps most accurately as a system of being loyal to the knowledge. But there has to be a beginning in knowledge. If a person makes a leap without any point of knowledge, we said that there's no way to justify that. Because you might as well make any leap. It doesn't have to be Torah. It could be anything. It could be anti. It could be a negative morality. There's nothing to choose between one system and another if it's blind from the beginning. It has to make sense. It has to be based in fact and in experience. Objectivity. That's what we said. Then we spent some time trying to follow the Jewish pathway of discovering this knowledge. But we said that if this knowledge is obtainable, then there must be a pathway that a person can follow in order to get that knowledge. So we began by saying that there are two areas. One of them is a mystical type of knowledge. Actually, it's much more real, that area. Much more tangible, much more real than rational knowledge. And that we haven't dealt with yet. But that's the place where Emunah really lies. And it's because that area is in the intuitive zone. It's an area of inner knowledge. That's why the misconception of blindness or blind faith has crept into the concept in English. That is, corresponds to something that's blind. We'll have to discuss that separately, try to understand what is this intuitive inner knowledge. It's a very difficult subject, since being an inner subject for which there are no words, it's very hard to put into words. But we'll try and deal with that in the future. We said that before we looked at that inner knowledge, which is the real, I'm saying again carefully, that's the real zone, the real area of this subject. What we're doing is just some pointers in the rational field that make it easier to approach that area, or make it more logical, or make a person perhaps who's logically bound and doesn't have meditational experience, make it more easy for such a person to consider looking at this area. But it's not the subject itself. However, in order to get to a certain place, you have to walk along the road to get there. Even though the road isn't the place, but you need the road in order to get there. And therefore we said it was a justifiable exercise to look at the rational side of faith, even though the two are in a sense a contradiction. That's what we wanted to do. And we approached that by saying that first we would handle the area of doubt. We looked at the fact that one can never clearly deny the possibility that there may be a transcendent reality. What should be the logical approach to handling such a possibility? For a person, sure. But just because it's possible, what should a person do? We approached that particular area. And then we went beyond that and we said that rational knowledge, the rational, intellectual, objective thinking approach to Torah, to faith, had two areas. We discussed one of them at length, and the other one we have to discuss this evening. The one we looked at before was the idea of the fact that we have a proof of an existence of a higher reality in that we experience it directly, and that was the Sinai experience. What was the giving of the Torah? The Sinai experience, we try to check it out. We try to examine what we are told about it. We try to check out its method of transmission and all the generations that handed down that wisdom to us. How reliable were they? Is it likely that the thing could have been forged? We try to look at it from that point of view. We try to examine the concept of having once met the divine level and experienced it directly. We try to examine the logical aspects of that concept. It's not what burns in the blood of a Jewish neshama, not through tradition and through having been brought up that way, and through the inner intuitive spark that is in every Jew. We try to look at it rationally for the skeptic. We try to examine that channel, and I think we managed to show that it's hard to assail meaningfully the reliability of that chain of transmission. We showed at least, that if somebody wishes to contest that, they need quite a heavy dose of emunah themselves. Because to make up an alternative, to make up the fact, to postulate that the thing was forged and faked, takes a lot of intellectual maneuvering to try and establish. That's where we left off. One more comment is needed, and that is, we said that when one looks at the area of spiritual knowledge objectively, and these two areas are what one looks at, the most important by far is the one that we've discussed already. What we can look at this evening is much less important. And that's how we discussed that first. Again, the two areas are as follows. First of all, the experiential approach, the fact that the Jewish people actually experienced the transcendence. We actually lived it, we were there. The only thing is that we personally, you and I, didn't experience it personally. Therefore, we have to go into the further step of checking out the transmission that handed down that tradition to us. And the other area we said is looking at the world objectively. Looking at the scientific objective facts in the world and seeing whether they speak of a higher reality or whether they speak against it. That's what we have to look at this evening. But we said, and this is very important to remember, that no amount of intellectual inquiry looking at the creation is worth anything like as much as checking out Jewish tradition. There are many reasons for it. Many reasons. First of all, it's just not as reliable. Because our purely intellect, we might certainly look at an issue in the world that can be looked at in two ways, and we might look at it the wrong way. We're just not powerful enough intellectually to be sure of having objectivity, number one. Two, not only aren't we powerful enough intellectually, we have too much emotional bias that gives us vested interest. We don't want to see things a certain way, right? When we look at a human being as being either the product of accident or the product of meaningful creation, there's a very powerful vested interest that makes a person want to see humans as an accident, because then it leaves you without obligations. The great thinkers of the last century say that the reason that evolution took hold in the Western mind is because the core of the idea of evolution is that it frees you from responsibility. If you're just an accidental monkey, then you don't have real moral obligations. If you're created by a divine creator who's relying on you to do something that he wants, you have very serious obligations, cosmic obligations. But if you're an accidental type of a gorilla, then you don't really have obligations no more than a gorilla does. So there's a very powerful vested interest in taking that line of thinking, and that skews the rational faculty. That's one reason. Another reason that the previous discussion was more important than this is because it adds a dimension that this discussion does not add. Let's just be careful about that. If you manage to come to a rational understanding that the world must have a transcendent root, let's say you could look at the creation, mathematics, science, subatomic physics, whatever it is, and you could see a definite proof there that the thing couldn't have generated itself. The deficiency of that line of thinking is that what it is that's the root of what you see is not clear. You with me? You can come to the verge of transcendence, you can come to the border and say, this thing must have a transcendent, there must be a zone that can't be measured in scientific terms, there must be, but what it is, you have no idea. Whereas if you accept, if you understand, if you investigate and come to a knowledge of the previous line of thinking, that is the tradition that we ourselves met Hashem, and that knowledge was handed down to us, you have a double advantage. One, you have an experience of a transcendent reality, but much more important, you have some idea about what it is. The fact that its version is Torah, right? That its application in the world is Torah, that the form that it takes is what we understand to be Torah and Torah obligation and mitzvahs, and that's the pathway. That's an enormous benefit that you don't have if you examine the world scientifically. The thinkers in this area, the Chokrim, those who delve into rational inquiry, they say that even that avenue gets you there indirectly, because if you look at the scientific world and you understand that something, the scientific world has evidence that something transcends it, the next question in your mind must be, what is the nature of that thing? And the answer must be, this is what they say, that if it exists, it's only logical that it would have communicated with us. To put a person into a situation, right, accepting that we're put here by a superior divine force, to put us here without any indication of what it is we're supposed to be doing, without any access to that information, is pointless. And therefore, if you are taking a logical approach, you don't have to do this, you can take an intuitive approach, but if you're already working logically, and you figure out that logically there must be a root to this thing, then the next step is that if it's logical that exists, it must be logical that it contains within it the information system about what it is and what it expects of us. But nevertheless, whether you accept that or not, it's still another step. It's still another step you have to make after looking at a rational level. Whereas the Sinai experience doesn't involve that at all, because and we said before, we try to make it clear that it's not only the Jews who accept the Sinai experience, there's no contesting that fact in the world. We try to be clear that even our most violent and vicious and brutal enemies accept fully and wholeheartedly the Sinai experience. Now, you can't find an enemy of the Jews who has denied that experience. The other major religions of the world, as you pointed out in great detail and carefully, also base themselves on the same tradition. They just add something onto the end of what they call our Torah, our document, our testament, whatever they might call it. They add a detail on the end. They add another prophet, another detail of revelation, and it makes big differences. But the basic revelation in its form, they don't even attempt to contest in any way at all. Which means there's very thin evidence contesting that line of thinking. However, since it is a valid line of thinking, let us look
at some objective scientific type facts. Let's look at that area. Let's make one comment of introduction first. The only thing that this comment does is serve to show that this line of thinking is even less relevant than I've already tried to show. That we try to say that it's the lesser of two possible avenues, which means that you've heard it already. You've heard the major evidence, right? If you want to pursue the rational line, the rational and the most important line in the power of Jewish Emunah is not tonight's discussion. We've had it already. I hope that's clear. That was last week and the previous week. That was the Sinai experience and what it means. That's what has to be checked out. When a person learns Torah, they intimately absorb that line of thinking and they check out that tradition. That has to be clear. But, since it is also a valid approach, we wish to look at it. But what we need is this particular introduction that has followed. I'm not sure who it was. One of the Torah Gedolim of the last generation made the following comment. This is a fascinating Torah idea, worth remembering. He said, if you look back in Jewish history, you'll see that the same problems have always confronted us. There have always been people who needed to deepen their understanding of Emunah. There were always people who needed an approach to Emunah. Right? I mean, people weren't just born accepting and knowing. People needed it to be put into their neshamas to be strengthened. There were always that fringe of the Jewish people who were not that convinced or who needed to work on the area to achieve an inner knowledge. But the interesting thing is, although the questions were always the same, the approach, the answer, how that knowledge is supplied has been different in each generation. A remarkable thing. If you look at it, the way he put it was this. If you look at the generation of the Rishonim, the Rambam, the Ramban, up to the time of the Kuzari, you find that the approach they took to Emunah was what's called Chakira. Chakira. To be Choike means to descend into intellectual rational inquiry, a very, very powerful intellectual way, and to derive certain incontrovertible philosophical facts. And to use those facts to prove others, and eventually to move along a pathway that arrives at some spiritual conclusion. From philosophical premises, the Rambam did it by taking Aristotle and working certain concepts that he used from a Torah point of view, showing where they're valid, showing where they're not valid. The Kuzari works through the whole discussion from beginning to end in a beautiful, logical way. The Rambam wrote the Moreh Nevuchim, the guide to the perplexed, for those who were intellectually perplexed. That was the style. If you look at later generations, if you look at these generations, you'll find that our teachers, the Achronim, those who lived after the time of the Kuzari, from the 15th, 16th century on, you find there's nothing like that. The work of the Achronim, of this generation, you'll find has not been intellectual inquiry. Their work has been on Torah, directly. The work has been making certain pathways clear in the spiritual world through mystical inquiry. There have been other expressions of approach to this problem, but none of them, to best of my knowledge, certain, if any, very few, took the line of intellectual, philosophical, rational inquiry. The question is why? The question is why? The question is why, when faced with the same problems, did each generation approach the answer, the approach to those problems, from a completely different point of view? It's a good question, right? Everything in Jewish tradition requires a deep understanding, nothing accidental. His answer was as follows. A wonderful idea tonight. He says this. Whatever force was around distracting Jews from what they should be understanding, whatever force was around distracting us, deflecting us from the spiritual knowledge that we should have, so according to the force that was a negative force, the positivity had to come by using those factors. That in the days of the Rishonim, what was around in the world was very powerful philosophical inquiry, based on Aristotelian theory, based on the early Greek philosophers. The people then had minds, the great intellects of the time, had minds capable of descending into very powerful examination of first principles. And because the doubts about Torah were raised from that quarter, so the answer had to be from that quarter. When the Rambam struggled against the community in which some of the intellectual Jews of the time, Arabic-speaking Jews, who were tending to question in one way or another the authenticity or the details of Jewish belief, the style they were using was the style of intellectual inquiry of the time. That's Arabic philosophy and mathematics and geometry based on Greek philosophy. It was a very powerful intellectual inquiry. And since that was the methodology of the approach, of the question, so the answer had to use the same, not to knock out those principles, on the contrary, to show the following principle, understand, carefully. It's not because since the enemy uses those tools, you have to use those tools. It's not correct. That's a mistake to understand that way. The correct understanding is this. In this area, if the enemy knows what he's doing, if the enemy is sharp, and he's basing himself not on nonsense and on evil-mindedness, if the enemy is basing himself on accurate, deep perceptions, then all you need to do is just look a bit more carefully at the same things he's using. Because if the enemy is worthy, there's a lot of truth in what he's saying. If the enemy of Jewish inquiry in that generation was deep, rational, intellectual philosophy, and we weren't dealing with fools, we're dealing with people who are really deeply questioning, just look with a fresh look at what they're saying and you'll see all the evidence to the contrary exactly there. And that comes from a deep mystical principle. I'm not going to go into detail. The mystical principle is that if you wish to find the truth, look for the biggest lie, what the mystics say, and in that lie you'll find all the evidence you need. Because the bigger the lie is and the more successful, the more it must be based on the truth, else it couldn't have existed. Only it's just being subtly looked at from one point of view that's not quite right. It looks exactly like the thing, actually it's a reflection of the thing. But a reflection, you follow me, if somebody holds up a mirror and they try and tell you that the thing in the mirror is the real thing, well, they're very, very wrong. It's a total illusion. It's just some rays of light. But don't discount it. Don't discard it. Look carefully into that mirror and you'll see the reality. You have to know the coding. Change right for left. Change this side for that side. You have to know the simple codes. But you have all the information. Don't disregard it. And therefore, if the style of... Are you with me? If the style and the nature of the attack and the inquiry was intellectual and philosophical, then that was the approach the Rambam used to show the truth. Right? Using the enemy, meeting him on his own ground. In the mystical tradition, there are many things based on this. I'll just share with you one wonderful idea. It's the reason that we say Kaddish in Aramaic. Why do we say Kaddish? The holiest, one of the most holy statements that there are, right, that a Jew could ever say is Kaddish. Kaddish means Kedusha, it means holiness. We don't say it in Hebrew. Hebrew, Lashon Kodesh, that's the language of holiness. Kaddish, we only say in Aramaic, which is the language of Tumah. In the mystical tradition, it's the language that's so close to the truth, and yet not quite it, that it's the language of negativity. The ultimate language of negativity is Aramaic. And we say Kaddish in Aramaic. Why do we do that? So in the mystical writings it says, because the evil forces, the negative forces in the angelic and spiritual spheres, I'm not going to go into what they are, they speak Aramaic. They can't speak Hebrew. They can't speak Lashon Kodesh. If you speak Hebrew, if you speak Lashon Kodesh correctly, you can only have the truth. Because the words mean exactly what they say, and there's no way to go wrong. What they use a language that's very close but slightly different. And because it's the language of Tumah, we want to hit them in their own... on their own turf. So when we say Kaddish, what we're doing with Kaddish, we're bringing Kedusha into the world, we're knocking out all evil, we're knocking out negative forces. So what we do, we meet them on their own ground. We don't miss them. We speak Hebrew and they're speaking Aramaic and miss them. No, we go into their turf. We use their, you follow, we turn their weapons around and face them. Beautiful, wonderful idea. That's what was done intellectually. The Rishonim took intellectual inquiry and they did it. The sad part of the story, that was nice what we discussed. The sad part of the story is this. No one today is attempting to approach this area rational intellectual. The great Achronim, the great thinkers, the Chazon Ish, the Chofetz Chaim, the great thinkers of the Achronim who worked, the Chazon Ish wrote the most amazing book on Emunah and Bitachon, a pamphlet, a classic on the Jewish obligation and understanding of belief, of faith, and what it can do. And he brings proofs there that it can turn the world upside down. He approaches it from Torah and he doesn't approach it rationally and philosophically. Unfortunately for us, there's only one message. The message is that if they're not using that ammunition, that means that we don't have the capabilities. That means, you follow, if the Jewish approach is not based on intellectualism, that means the enemy is not using it. The enemy today, in other words, is not an intellectual approach. The enemy today, you have to understand this clearly, the enemy today is not cool, level-headed, rational inquiry. That's not today's problem. Look around you, you'll see. Today what speaks loudly is the crudest and coarsest element of the body. That's what the problem is today. You follow me? Today, no Jews out there in the streets arguing with major intellectual philosophy. That's not the problem. Young Jews are not being swept away by very powerful philosophers who are able to rationalize for them and prove to them the opposite. That's not the problem. Today's problem is so coarse, that it's in the mystical system below the diaphragm. Well below the diaphragm. Come into where the vital organs are, never mind the head. Very, very far below. In fact, if you want to know how far below, it says clearly in the mystical tradition, and I'll just illustrate this detail and we'll try and look at what's relevant to us more directly. It says in the deeper tradition that this generation, if you want to know, where are we holding in this generation? So the Rishonim, the earlier generations were holding in the head. The level was rational, intellectual, was mystical, spiritual, that's what it was. As you go down, the next generation was holding lower. We are holding at the soles of the feet. That's where we are. We're the bottom of the feet. Quite literally. This generation is called Ikhvasa the Meshecha, the footprint. It means that Ikhvasa means the Akevayim, it's the bottom of the heels of the messianic structure. It means that the 6,000 years of the world's history have a human form. And the 6,000 year, which is what we're in now, right? We're 5751 now. There's only 249 years left until the definitive end of time as we understand it. So we're in the very, very tail end of history. and history looks like a human, which means that it goes down and down and down. And this generation is the soles of the feet. In fact, the generation is called Ifrit of Mashiach, which means the footprints or the under soles of the Mashiach. That's what it means. If you work it out for a moment, you'll see it's not imaginative. You'll see it's as accurate as you can imagine. And the mystics go into it in great detail. It says in the Gemara clearly that the defining characteristic of the soles of the feet is that they are dead even when you're alive. That's the nature of the soles of the feet. It says in Avatari Nosson, one of the great chazals that deals with this area, it says that everything in the human corresponds to something in the world. If you look at that thing in the world, you'll find it in the human. There's a thing in the world called Malach HaMavis. That's the power of death in the world. Where do you find that in the human? In the heels, in the feet. Because the feet are that which are dead already. And in fact, it shouldn't take you more than 2 minutes of thought to trace the source of this. The source is that when death came to the world, where was it? In Gan Eden. Now, if you remember when Chava, Eve, dealt with the serpent, which was the force of death, what was the curse that was left to the world? That you will bruise his head and he will bruise your heel. That means when the snake bites, he bites in the heel. And the mystics say it means the poison is in the heel already. The question is just how quickly it spreads. It takes 70 years, 80, 120 years, but it spreads. But the poison stays there. If there wouldn't be the poison in the heel, there'd be nothing to spread and you could never die. But death starts there. It's in the soles of the feet. And those who look at it from a slightly different point of view, they say that if you look at the soles of the feet, you'll see that they aren't alive. The sensations that the rest of the body has, you don't have in the soles of the feet. The soles of the feet, you can cut them. They're insensitive to pain. They're very, very insensitive. You stand on them, they're thick. They're very, very dead and insensitive. There are those who take it further, and they say that this is not fanciful, this is very, very deep. The soles of the feet are insensitive to all sensory modalities except to being tickled. That means it's a remarkable phenomenon. This part of the body, you'd have to go a long way to explain how that worked out evolution-wise. There are a good few million years of accidents to work out that the least sensitive part of the body happens to be the most sensitive to that modality. It's a remarkable accident there. Ask them to explain to you what its survival value is. I wouldn't do it. But if you want to ask them, but nevertheless, that's what we see. So you have the soles of the feet that are insensitive to anything, but for external superficial stimulation, they're the most sensitive part of the body. It's a remarkable phenomenon. What does it mean? It means this generation is insensitive to anything real. It can be cut and brutalized and butchered, and whatever meaningful torture can be done to this generation, they blithely go on, totally oblivious. But superficial stimulation, not cheap thrills, cheap laughter that doesn't have any content, that's exactly what this generation is. That's exactly the soles of the feet. That's exactly what it is. And therefore they say that this generation is one that takes only the wrapping. The internal content, they're not interested. If you're not tickling me, if you're not stimulating me, if I don't get a kick out of it, I'm not interested. That's this generation. Mashmas, what it means inwardly to hear it and understand it, nobody's interested. If it doesn't give me an immediate thrill, if it's not an instant success, something that I feel on my flesh immediately, not interested at all. That's this generation. Remarkable thing. And that's the explanation of why the attitude to this generation is not to go into internal logic and wrangling intellectually and rationally, because that's not where this generation is. This generation is holding in the wrapping. Someone said it's not even the wrapping, it's the wrapping of the wrapping of the wrapping of the advertising of the wrapping. Something like that, that's what it is. But it's nowhere near the content, inner content of it. That's an explanation, a basic Jewish understanding of why the approach in this generation is not powerful, rational inquiry. It's not what it is. It's experiential, and that's what. You'll see also the movement to Eastern sects and cults and so forth is not through rational inquiry. It's through an emotional rejection of what the West is, and it's through an emotional experiential awareness of what the East is. Now, having said that, let's look at what we can look at in terms of rational inquiry. If it's true that the tools that we have to use or what they are using on the outside, we're going to have to look at science. If the proofs against religion are coming from the scientific world, if they think that the proofs are that they're looking at the world rationally and a rational, scientific, modern, technological mind doesn't see spirituality, if that's what they say, we're going to have to look at science and technology and see if it does say that. That's going to be our approach, right? Using the same principles we've said before with the puny intellect that is at our disposal. Let's start as follows. First of all, let's try to connect it to what we discussed last time. Let's try and make the transition from Torah and its tradition into science, right? Last time we began the subject by mentioning the hidden mathematical codes in the Torah. You remember? I don't know who was here and who wasn't here. We mentioned the mathematical codes within Torah as a connection with a deeper issue in the tradition that connects with scientific, it's amenable to scientific inquiry. There's another area that bridges the gap between the Torah tradition and the scientific and factual world, and it's as follows. This is a favorite theme of many mashgichim. They will often use this idea, and I'll share it with you very briefly. You can check it out yourself and examine it more fully. Apart from codes, there are some remarkable statements in Torah that are wide open to being disproved. And nobody would ever make a statement that can be disproved if he wasn't saying the truth. The only way you could ever make a statement that's wide open to being disproved, if you don't have all the knowledge at your disposal, the only way, in other words, you would stick your neck out and make a statement that might turn out to be false later, the only way you do that is if you're confident that it wouldn't turn out to be false later. So the Torah would stick its neck out and say that such and such a thing will never happen, and you can base your emunah on that. Well, that is a proof, according to this line of thinking, that the Torah must have had divine inspiration. Because nobody would rip. Let me give you an example. There are famous examples. One of them is the fact that when the Torah describes kosher and unkosher animals, it gives the criteria for kosher and unkosher animals. The animal has to chew the cud and has split hooves. And the Torah then proceeds to say that there are only three animals that have one and not the other. One particular one and not the other particular one. And it names what they are. Now, that's a remarkable thing. That means when Moshe Rabbeinu handed down the Torah to the people who lived in that generation, you must remember that that was a generation that's only recently that the world has been fully explored. First of all, you could argue that the world hasn't been fully explored, that there may well be species of animals that may yet be discovered somewhere deep in the Amazon basin, right, that may have one feature, that may have maybe another animal that has one of those features and not the other. And the Torah confidently says that you will never find another one. But if you take it in context, you'll find it even more remarkable. Because this statement was said to a generation of Jews when continents had not yet been discovered. When the intellectual aware world knew that the ambit of what they were familiar with in geographical terms was very limited. You must remember there were generations that humans went through thinking that you'd fall off the edge if you went far enough. They were completely aware that their scope was very, very limited. And for many centuries there were major discoveries of new continents that were coming in. And despite that, whoever handed the Torah on from father to son was prepared to say that categorically you will never discover another animal that has this biological feature and not that one. It's a remarkable thing, except these three. It's a remarkable fact, and of course it's never been done. No one ever has, despite the discovery of many new continents and jungles and so forth and so on. That's a remarkable confidence, right, that no other religion or spiritual system has ever stuck its neck out to make statements like that. Fact one. Fact two, there are many of these. Well, there's a certain number of them. Another one is that there's a promise in what's called Aliyah L'Regel. Three times a year, when the Jews lived in Israel, they had an obligation to go up to the Beis HaMikdash, to Yerushalayim. They had to spend the Yom Tov, the Chagim, over there, and then they went back to their homes. And it took a long time. It took time to travel from their homes, from the far borders of Eretz Israel. They had to travel, they had to spend time in Beis HaMikdash, and they had to travel all the way back. And in the time that they left their homes, there's a Torah promise that no harm would ever come to their homes. That means they were surrounded by enemies, violent and vicious enemies, constantly looking to maraud and to do damage, and there was a Torah promise that you don't have to worry. Leave no one, leave your farms and homes empty. All of you come to Yerushalayim. That's the exact opposite of any security system. Anybody with any security consciousness would definitely not do that. You protect the borders. In fact, at times when they lived on the borders, there were special places called Arei HaSfar, the cities of the border, which were fortifications, because they were the first line of defense against attack. That's how the Jewish people lived. And when it came to Yom Tov, Pesach, everybody put everything down, they left their houses open, they went up to Yerushalayim, and it was stated that never will any damage ever come to you. And in all the centuries that they lived in Eretz Israel, never was any damage ever recorded anywhere. In fact, there are many, many stories of people who came back, and the neighbors said to them that when you left, we wanted to come in to your homes and your farms and attack and take everything away, but we couldn't. We saw people going in and out all the time. There were beings going in and out of those houses all the time. We were too afraid to approach, and there wasn't anyone there. And all the Jews. In all the centuries, there was never recorded such a thing. Now, you have to be very, very confident to be able to say that you all do this, leave everything unprotected, it will be fine, and to be confident that it always would be, and it always was. There are others. I'll share with you one more. There's a famous promise that says, what talks about Eimet Achar Kosleinu, standing behind our wall. It's in Shir HaShirim where it talks about a beautiful image of peering through the latticework, standing behind the wall. But the deep meaning of it is this, that there's a wall that the Shekhinah will always stand behind. You know which wall that is. And that wall has an absolute watertight Torah promise that no matter what happens to the Beis HaMikdash, that wall will never fall. That wall will never be destroyed. So that's a remarkable promise. To make a promise like that centuries ago, that the Western Wall will always stand, no matter what. Doesn't matter what weapons they throw at the Beis HaMikdash, the Western Wall will always stand. You know? That's a promise you can rely on. Now you have to be very, very confident. You know what happened to the Beis HaMikdash? The Beis HaMikdash was razed to the ground. literally raised into rubble, raised to the ground, burnt and wrecked. The Romans plowed it under. There's an account of how the Romans not only plowed it under and salted the ground. They wanted the ground to be so infertile that nothing would ever grow. They're not even weeds. Not only did they do that, but they brought in massive earth-moving efforts to demolish the whole top of the mountain. Now, they didn't just want to do away with the stones. There's a record of a major attempt that they made to actually move part of the mountain away so that the site of the base of Mikdash wouldn't be standing. And despite that, the Western world still stands. So you may be sure that nuclear weapons aren't going to touch it. Doesn't matter what's going to happen, that wall's going to stand. I must add a paradox over here, because it's a deep subject and we can't, if there's some other time we can go into it separately, but I must issue a warning, and that is that we know that the final test will be proofs against Torah. You have to bear that in mind. We know that the final ordeal will be proofs that we're wrong. What you might think are our deepest proofs will be let down by those. And proofs that everybody else is right. And only people who hold strong in Emunah then, when it's not easy, will see the final redemption. So you have to be very careful. It's a promise that it's there. But one has to know. If other things collapse that you might have had confidence in, you have to hold on anyway. But it's a separate subject. I'm just saying that as a warning because we're dealing with proofs and things that won't change. Now, those are some Torah ideas about things that a very unusual system. The system has to be a very unusual one if you will commit yourself to things like that with a confidence, and they stood the test of many, many centuries, 3,000 years, 3,200 or more years, those promises have remained absolutely untouched. It's a remarkable idea. Let's take the next step and look into the physical world. Let's look at the scientific world. Let's transition now from Torah and science to science alone. The problem, as I'm sure you're aware, and my problem in discussing this is not to get too technical. The real fascination of this area is to go into the technical areas. Now, first of all, I'm not an expert at any of the technical areas, just have a slight knowledge of some of them. And second, I'm sure that not all of you are experts in any one of these. Particularly, you might not be interested in hearing lengthy scientific. So let's just try and take a look at certain areas. Those who are interested can check it out. The references are available. You can check it out from the experts in those fields and see how deep this actually goes. But let's make reference to one or two areas from the scientific world. The problem is that the popular convention is that if you look at modern science, you'll see a world of evidence that speaks against religion. That's the misconception. That the more scientific knowledge you have, the less feasible, the less tangible, the less logical it becomes to have a spiritual conception. That's the idea. Our contention is that it's exactly the opposite. The more scientific knowledge, the greater detail, the more we understand in the Bria, the more we see a design. The more we see that it speaks of a spiritual reality. One. Two, not only does it speak that there must be a spiritual reality, but actually examining the scientific evidence actually says exactly the same thing as the mystical world. Not that they discover wonderful scientific things and so we see a beautiful system. And since we know that a system must have been designed by a system's designer, we can deduce that they must not like that, much more than that. The design itself is exactly the way the spiritual wisdom says. Anybody who studies any Kabbalistic wisdom and then examines the scientific and physical world will be amazed to find that the structure they're setting up there, without even knowing it, and even our enemies, who are trying to set up the scientific world in order to disprove religion, are coming up with exactly the same statements as the mystics have been saying for centuries. I'll give you a personal example. It happened to me not so long ago. You know, you need a bit of background for this. You know that in the mystical system, there are 10 dimensions to the world. You're probably aware of that. There are 10 things called spheres, 10 mystical dimensions to the world. It has to be understood what they are, lengthy discussion, but there are 10, I'm sure you know about this, 10 points, as we've often mentioned this here, 10 points on which the world is built, and they are described as dimensions to the world. But in the mystical tradition, it also says that interweaving with those 10 are 26. Because the Yud Kei Vav Kei, if you spell out the name of Hashem, you'll see it adds up to 26. Add up the letters, adds up to 26. And therefore, the elements that create the world must be the 10 mystical dimensions and the 26 mystical aspects of Hashem's name. And both of them interweave. And in the spiritual wisdom, the most amazing thing is to see how both of them fit together. If ever you have a description of a mystical reality, you'll find that the mystics describe it first, how it fits into the structure of 10, and then they'll show you how it fits in to the mystical structure of 13 on the right and 13 on the left, and how the two enmesh and interweave. It's one of the deepest and best known subjects in mystical wisdom. That's what it is. Now, some time ago I was walking on the campus of the Hebrew University, and there I was going to a scientific exhibition there for children, when I demonstrate certain scientific principles, very beautifully done. As I was crossing the campus, I saw a friend whom I hadn't seen for many years. We were at school together, and this person had now become a professor of applied mathematics at Stanford. The outstanding genius, who's not religious yet, who happened to have been visiting Israel on a sabbatical. At least he wasn't then, by night probably. So I met him and we got talking about things. So he told me about his mathematical work and some of the... And he told me the following thing. That the most fascinating area... Listen carefully to this. It's a very important thing. I'm not going to go into the technicalities, but listen to the generality of it. The most fascinating area in modern mathematics... In fact, it's not only mathematics, it's modern science in general, especially physics, subatomic physics, is the attempt to describe the world in terms of just one theory. You're probably aware that up to recently, the world has been described in terms of many theories. There's physics, electromagnetics, thermodynamics. There are many different systems, most of which agree with each other. However, certain of them don't seem to be based on the same postulate. And the major attempt now is to pull together all the theories. They're looking for what they call guts. If you look at the scientific literature, you'll see they're looking for guts. What are guts? G-U-T. Grand unifying theories. That's what they're looking for. The theories that pull all other theories together. And there's been some remarkable advances in this area, particularly from Cambridge. You can read the book written by the professor over there. It's called The Brief History of Time. It's a fascinating discussion of the subject in lay terms. And many other works have been written about it recently. Right now, they're down to two theories. Right now, the scientific community universally accepts that the whole universe can be described in terms of two theories. One is quantum mechanics and one is relativity. The major thrust now of the prize-winning, Nobel Prize-winning and other great minds is to try and see what connects the two theories. That's the work, right? They want to try and find how relativity theory and quantum mechanics actually could be described as being based on this, and they haven't done that yet. There's an attempt recently, but no one's done it confidently yet and proved it. Now, he was describing all this to me and telling me that in the research that's being pursued, and of course you understand what these scientists are doing. This is information that isn't necessarily useful in terms of, no one's going to build a machine out of this. What they're doing is searching for the root of reality. What they're doing, it's a remarkable thing, you have to understand carefully, what the scientific world is searching for is the root and origin of reality. Why they want to tie everything into one theory is to see the origin of everything in cosmology, astronomy, cosmology, and cosmogony now. The big work now is to show what was the Big Bang. What was the origin of... That's not going to do anything useful for anyone, I can assure you. Not going to make any use out of that. There's no machines you can build. There's no modern conveniences that are going to be modeled on any understanding of the Big Bang. There's no question. It's a purely philosophical enterprise, and it's the major work of all astrological research at the moment. You have to understand that mankind is searching very deeply for its roots. Evolution and understanding of man, anthropology, is exactly the same thing. What are we and where do we come from? I'll share with you some fascinating ideas in that field as well. They deny that they're looking for anything spiritual. They say they want to trace reality back to its physical source to prove that it's only a physical source. Yeah? That's what they say. But nevertheless, the attempt is to... So he's describing all this to me. He tells me that the following problem is what's been reached. The problem is this. In the research to trace the origin, the mathematical origin, in terms of these theories, origins of the world, they've now come down to a set of equations. This is what he tells me. That means, in these theories of relativity, and in the theories of quantum mechanics, all of it can be described by a series of equations. But the interesting thing about these equations is that the only way to solve these equations, and by the way, if you do this, you can solve all equations simultaneously, is that you have to postulate that they're more than four dimensions. That's what he tells you. If you try and solve these equations, understanding that they're three physical dimensions and time, the equations aren't solved at all. You have to postulate more than four dimensions, more than three, more than four dimensions. So I said to him, well, how many dimensions is it? He said it's a remarkable thing. No one understands why. But all the whole set of entire equations are solved by a factor of 10 and by 26. Both those factors, when these scientists, time and again, they slot these two numbers in and everything settles. All the equations solve themselves. And it's Ramon Arnold says, I said to him, why didn't they ask me? In the area of biology, I'm trying to choose one or two examples. It's a long and beautiful, complex discussion. For those with more scientific background, it's more meaningful. I'm deliberately going to avoid evolution because evolution, first of all, is not such a problem anymore. I don't know if you're aware of that. 5, maybe 10 years ago, anyone who suggested that evolution might be sort of inaccurate was immediately thought of as a medieval, raving, rabid type of some kind of fanatic, and he wasn't considered worthy of, he was put on trial in a number of places. But today, there's very serious questioning of the validity of evolution in scientific terms from within the scientific community, not from religious thinkers, but from within the scientific fold. And I'm very happy, that is one area that I happen to have a little bit more background on than some of the others. If people want to, we can make a separate occasion for those who are particularly interested in that area to have a more full discussion of the concept of, I don't want to bore the people who don't have the biological background or who are not simply interested in that area. But I can assure you simply that tracing evolution, or what they call evolution, proves just as clearly the Torah and mystical description of the commonality between all living beings as it does the theory that they set up that a primitive organism became a more complex one. That's the first angle. The second angle, again, which I'm not going to go into detail, is that the theory needs to be examined on scientific terms, and you'll see that rationally it's very poor. Rationally, scientifically, it's a very, very, very poor and weak theory. There's tremendous conflicting evidence within the theory that suggests exactly the opposite. It's a fascinating study in logic, and for those who are interested, we can do that some other time. But, let me share with you one or two of the outcomes of that research. I'll just share with you one that you may have even seen in the popular press some time ago. 2 or 3 years ago, the work was published. Some of you may not know about it. Remarkably, uncannily, every line of inquiry that's been taken in paleontology, in geological research relating to evolution, the answers that have come out of the research, the most fascinating way, have shown exactly what we've always claimed from a religious point of view. Not that they are working simply to disprove the posits of evolution or science. That's not the point. The point is that when they're looking to do that, they end up with a tremendously unexpected result. And that unexpected result, time and again now, points to exactly the way we conceive the world. They're looking for the origin of the universe. They think that it had no beginning, no origin. All evidence points now to one single moment in time. That time began with what's called the Big Bang. But that's exactly what we say. Right now, they're a little bit out on the number of years. They just got a couple of extra noughts on. They'll get them down eventually. But the idea, they tweak to the idea. Now, the time's getting less, by the way. The time units are shrinking as new evidence comes in. And in every case, they seem to be coming up with the same concept. I'll share with you one fascinating example. About 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, major work was published from 2 research centers in the United States at the same time. And I'll share with you an insight. I'll tell you what the experiment was. Mine, very, very powerful idea. These 2 groups of researchers, nothing to do with religion, not trying to prove any spiritual religious point of view, tried to assess with a new genetic tool, which I'll describe to you briefly, the origins of the human race. In other words, they wanted to know that if you look at racial groups in the world, can you trace them down to common stock? In other words, you follow. Could you look at certain Eastern racial groups? And could you trace their origin back? And could you trace certain Western groups? And could you find that actually the origins of these different human groups in the world are actually fewer than the number of groups now? Maybe you'll find that certain unexpected groupings actually are related if you go back far enough. That was the idea. You follow me? Could you find maybe that actually it was quite a small pool of human-type genes that fanned out into what's been done today? That's what. Why did they do this research? Because a new tool became available. The new tool is as follows. I'm not going to go into the technicalities, I'm not an expert at it, but in general it's as follows. You know that the problem with tracing human stock is that whenever you want to look at a human genome, you want to look at the genetic structure of a human, right, at a genetic level, which we can do very efficiently now, you can look at the coding of the genes, and there are many, many aspects to gene coding which are not specific for what they code for, at least what we don't know. In other words, the problem is this. Okay, the fact is as follows. If you map out the sequence, it will then turn out that 2 brothers, or brother and sister, siblings in the same family, should have very, very closely related sequences, right? Because the only time a difference creeps in is by a chance mutation. Sometimes the gene reproduces itself in such a way that a very tiny segment is inverted. Let's say 2 amino acids are in opposite sequence to here. But it happens at a very, very low rate, according to what's observed. Which means that for many, many, many generations, you could trace people in a family, and the family would always have an almost identical, right? Over centuries, they would creep in very, very slight changes in widely distant branches of the same family. Do you follow me? The problem, however, is this. That the coding is put together from the mother and the father. And when they mix in, they distress, they confuse the code. Because the half comes from the father, half from the mother. And since you can't know which comes from where, the coding is disrupted. However, the recent discovery, and this was the key to the whole thing, there's one part of the body that contains a gene code only from the mother. By the way, in mystical terms, this is the most amazing discovery, because the mystically that makes perfect sense. Again, tonight is scientific night, not mystical night, but I can assure you it ties in with the deepest mystical roots. But the thing is this, there's a part of the cell which is called the mitochondria. The mitochondria are the parts of the cell from which energy comes. Right? And the genes that code for the mitochondria come only from the mother. They reflect only the maternal side of the genetic coding. It's fascinating mystically because the mitochondria produce all the energy in the body. And mystically, it's only the female side that has any power. That's what it says mystically. Sorry to tell you that. But mystically, that's what it is. The male side is just a very, very wispy, weak aspect of reality. What can I tell you? Didn't say anything. That's what it is. So now what they try to do is that for now with this tool at their disposal, they try to take representative samples of human beings all over the world, and they actually what they did, they used placental tissue, they used tissue from placentas, and they took cells from the placentas of these women and they examined the code of the amino acid sequences in the mitochondria. And each child, of course, had exactly the same pattern as his mother, regardless if he's a boy or girl, because there's no mixing of the father's genes in here. Correct. So they had the following brilliant idea. We'll take samples from women all over the world, representative samples from people all over the world, and we'll analyze the gene sequences, and we'll see how widely they differ. Because let's say the people who live in Samoa split off, right, anthropologically in the history of the development of man, let's say split off from the people who live in southern China, I don't know, let's say 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 10,000 years ago, whatever it is. So then, there would be 10,000 or 5,000 years worth of chance differentiations creeping in. Now, you follow me. If they were brothers 5,000 years ago, and one moved off in that direction with no connection anymore, so then in this limb, you would have chance mutations creeping in, right? One in every 40, 50, 100 years, whatever. And in this limb, you would have, and they would look different. The similarity would indicate how closely they are related. You know what came out of the research? Absolutely conclusively from both centers, and it's never been contested since. Listen carefully to this. That all humans on earth descended from one woman. That's what the research showed. Right? Absolutely incontrovertibly, beyond all shadow of doubt. They called her Eve, by the way. If you read the scientific literature, you'll see that they decided to codename this woman Eve. That's what it says, okay? For want of a better word, that's what it says. So what did they publish? It's fascinating to see how blind people can be. They published the studies, and of course, knowing the rate of gene mutation, you can take the slight differences and trace them back to where they must be identical and put a date to it. Because we know the rate of change. And if there's this percentage error at the widest compared to this branch, then knowing the rate of change, assuming it's been constant, which is not so simple, but they made that assumption, we can go back and put a date to when that one woman lived. And they put it at 300,000 years ago. Which, by the way, is fantastic and remarkable, because in normal anthropological research, that's astounding. Because we're talking in millions, normally, according to any commonality of ancestry. And yet they're talking 300,000 years ago, which is yesterday, in anthropological terms. What did they come up with? The same studies, it's unbelievable, the same studies that came up with this fact, that so many years ago, there was one woman who was the progenitor of all humans alive today. They said they add on the following scientific journal, add the following writer. Of course this is impossible, that's what they write. Of course it's not logical. And therefore, there must have been many other women around at the time, but what must have happened is that the offspring of all the others must have died out, and the offspring of this one happens to be us. Where's the evidence? Where's the evidence for offspring of others who died out? There is no evidence. Where's the evidence that there were other women around who weren't fortunate enough, right, to have, you know, us as their grandchildren? There isn't any evidence. But since it's illogical to them, it sounds dangerously close to what the fanatics are saying. So they formulate, they come up, they suck out of their thumb the fact that there must have been other bands of women roaming the earth who produced offspring and didn't quite make it into the mainstream. And that sort of. But of course, if you take the naked facts from their own mouths, you see very, very fascinating insight into. In the field of cosmology and cosmogony, you see the same thing. There was a long time of debate about the origins of the universe. It was incontrovertible evidence, or so it seemed, that the universe is expanding. And therefore, if it's expanding, it must have started at a point, and they put a date to it. At the moment, the figure is 10 billion years, approximately 10 billion years ago, formation of Earth at about 5 billion years ago, 5,000 million. And at that date, there was what they call the Big Bang. What happened before that, and who was responsible for it, and how it came into being, they don't question. This year, for the first time, someone told me at a cosmology congress, an astronomy congress, one of the speakers got up and said the following statement to his scientific colleagues. Gentlemen, the scientific world now agrees with the first word of the Bible. That's what he said. because all the evidence points to a beginning, that the universe exploded out of nothingness. How do they deal with that fact? What do they say about it? What's their interpretation? Well, of course, it's very illogical that the thing began out of nothing, something from nothing now. Probably what happened was that it was there before, but it was contracting down to nothing. And when it got to nothing, it expanded again into something. That's what they say. Where did that original thing that was expanding and slowly contracting come from? They say, well, it probably started at a small point of nothingness that expanded into something rapidly. But when it got big enough, it started contracting down to nothingness. And then, how long has this been going on? No, this has been going for a long time. By the way, even that crazy idea was put to the test, because the theory was that when the universe expands strongly enough, eventually the force of attraction between all particles and with the loss of energy that would be the result of the expansion would eventually start to collapse again. So a calculation was made of the amount of available energy in the universe to see if that would happen, and it was disproved. In other words, the overwhelming idea was that it's expanding continually and will not reach a point at which it's going to contract, which puts out of action, at least from that theoretical point of view, that thing. So you have that. There's much more fascinating research, on the borders. There's Australian work recently, which I'll just share with you. Unfortunately, this work was done by a believing religious person, because it takes away some of its credibility. You follow? It's done by a believing Christian. Work that's been done by a very devoutly believing Christian, who happens to be one of the foremost names in the scientific community. He has done this scientific work, and being openly admitted to be a believer takes away some of his credibility. People think that if he's a believer, so then the mathematics that he's using must have an error someplace. But what can I say? But the work that he's done shows a very, very fascinating idea, and that is that what they call dynamic time. I'm not going to go into the details. I can give you the references again. I have a copy myself. You can check it out. Very fascinating work, which was actually solicited by a certain American center for Stanford Institute of Research, actually solicited this research from this particular Australian. And the work shows the following thing, that there's a discrepancy between dynamic time and atomic time. Remarkable idea. I'm not going to go into detail, but what the work shows is this, that if you measure dynamic time means time that's measured in the universe by non-atomic phenomena. For example, by cosmic events. If you take what they do, they measure the time of rotation of the moon, right, by what's called precession. They check how the moon passes in front of a very distant star, and they check exactly the time period taken for it to do that again. And they establish a periodicity. Then they check time by the atomic method. You know what that is? The vibration of certain vibrations of certain molecules that have a very intensely accurate rhythmicity, what your quartz watch is based on. And the cesium nucleus, they check the vibration of the cesium nucleus, and they make a so-called cesium clock, and that has an unsurpassed degree of accuracy. The unfortunate fact is that the latest discovery shows that the two times don't agree. The two times are progressing out of phase. And not only are they progressing out of phase, but they're progressing out of phase according to mathematical relationship. And if you derive the mathematical relationship and you project it back, it's an exponential relationship. And it works out to be, listen to this, fascinating, that the discrepancy today is infinitesimal. But as you take it back, the discrepancy becomes exponentially greater, listen carefully, to the point that if you go back a certain amount of time in dynamic time, the discrepancy in atomic time comes to be millions and millions of times out of phase with dynamic time. What does it mean? Let me translate it to you, okay? I'll translate it, you know what I'm talking about, right? I've no idea myself. If I translate it for you into, right, I didn't about failed arithmetic, okay, it's cool. But I'll translate it for you into, if you go back 5,000 years, listen carefully, we're in 5751, and they've got beautiful graphs showing it, by the way, marking out exactly. And by the way, it's been documented also by records of meteorites, astrological events that hit the Earth, in terms of conventional time, how many millions of years ago it must have happened, connected with the period that should be the flood, and various other cosmic events according to biblical chronology, and they map exactly to each other. They map exactly. But let me just give you the overall idea. Overall idea is this. If you go back 5,000 years, listen carefully. Listen very well. I know you've been sleeping tonight, but listen now. If you go back 5,000 years, in conventional time, the display of atomic time then takes you back to how much? 10 billion years. You follow me? If you map, you follow what, which means that all cosmic phenomena that we can measure that are not dependent on atomic phenomena give you a history of 5,000 years. If you check atomic phenomena, like geological phenomena, fossilization, any chemical processes, any of the evidence of how old the world is, you'll read 10 billion. For the Earth, 5 billion. You follow what's going on? You realize what's being explained here? that if you carbon date, or you argon, radio argon date, remains of things, and you get figures of 5 billion years, according to this graph that corresponds exactly to the 5,000 years that we're talking about, a fascinating thing. While I'm on the subject, I'm not saying this work has been accepted, this is recent, only the last couple of years, 2 years ago it was published, but nevertheless it's something to think about. Not yet controverted, no one yet has, everyone agrees to the discrepancy, by the way. What it means is subject to debate, but everyone agrees to the observed facts, that no one has objected to. I'll just share with you, if you don't, you mind one more scientific, can you handle it? One more scientific thing, because it's so fascinating. A group of French workers, some years ago, did the following experiment. Actually, I don't have the reference for this, but I saw it. I saw a translation of the paper, of a reference. They did the following thing. I'm not going to go into a lengthy debate about it. I'll just give you the basic idea. You know that, what I'm trying to show you, is that we look at the enemy. We look at what the enemy's saying, and right there you'll find exactly the truth. You'll find exactly the evidence. You won't just find that he's wrong. That's easy. You'll find that he's saying exactly what we say, by his own admission. Are you with me? You know, one of the major problems has always been dating. We say the world is 5751 years old. Something from nothing at that time. That's when it happened. They say that the world is 10 billion years old. Okay, fine. Now, if you take objective measuring tools, take carbon dating. Carbon dating's only got a half life of a couple of thousand years. So you can only date things with carbon dating, some 50, 60, 100,000, something like that. So that order of magnitude. But nevertheless, if you carbon date fossils, if you take trees that are fossilized, you know what I'm talking about, and you carbon date them, you definitely show ages that are older than 5,700. There's no question about it. Okay? You get dates there that are 30, 40, 50, 60,000 years old. And according to Torah belief, the world has only been here 5,700 years ago. No question. Now, you seem to have a scientific objective tool, and Torah doesn't object to objective scientific inquiry. If you've got a tool that can be used and checks out, then there's no reason you have to deny it because of your faith. You look at the fact. What are you going to do with this? What are you going to do? So a French group did the following thing. Fascinating piece of research. This was a non-religious team. They did the following thing, to the best of my knowledge. They did the following thing. You have to know that all dating systems are based on an assumption. I'm not going to go into the mathematics of it, but very briefly, for those who have any background, all dating systems are based on an assumption. The assumption works as follows. Very, very briefly, I promise you, I won't bore you with the details. Very briefly, the assumption is as follows. Carbon dating works by measuring the proportion of radioactive carbon to non-radioactive carbon in biological material, okay? What's called C14, which is radioactive, to C12, vice versa, C12 to C14, the proportion. And it so happens that proportions are stable in the environment. If you take carbon from a living tree today, you will find that it's made up of what's called C14, and a tiny percentage is C12. But the interesting thing is, all biological material in the world has the same proportion. Because C12 and C14 is utilized the same way biologically, and therefore, all organic material utilizes, metabolizes these two carbons in the same way. So everything that's alive has the same proportion. But the amazing fact is this. When a tree dies and it stops incorporating carbon, what happens is it's frozen with its complement of carbon atoms. And then what happens is the radioactive carbon disintegrates, decays as they call it, into non-radioactive carbon. Which means that the proportion of radioactive carbon to normal carbon falls off with time. You with me? And it falls off at a predictable rate, what's known as the half-life. At a certain given time, there will be half of what there was before that time at a predicted mathematical slope. Are you with me? What does it mean? It means, if you dig up a tree that died yesterday, you will find it has the same proportion of C14 to C12 as a tree that's alive today, correct? But if it died 20,000 years ago, it will have a much lower proportion because it's all been disintegrating with time. And if it was 40,000 years ago that tree died, it will have much less than that. Are you with me? Of course, you have to remember it's based on a massive assumption. What's that? You don't have to be a mathematical genius to know. Anybody with a scientific mind will know immediately. It's based on the assumption that 40,000 years ago, when the tree died, the same proportions of C12 to C14 were in the atmosphere then. It's an assumption. You follow me? If the tree died 40,000... You don't need a Gemara head for this, right? If the tree died 40,000 years ago with the same proportion of C12 to C14 as now, if that's true, then of course the figures today would be an accurate reflection. Are you with me? Now, is it a valid assumption? Can you make an assumption like that? Can you assume that 50,000 years ago, the amount of radioactive carbon in the universe was the same proportion as today? They assume it was. So over the last period, people decided to see if the rate is constant. They decided to check out the rate of carbon-14 to C12 in there and see if it's constant. They found it's not. It's not constant at all. C14, it turns out, is formed in the atmosphere by C12 being pounded by cosmic radiation, exciting it to the level of C14. But the interesting thing is that with time, the overall proportion of C14 is increasing. And it's measurable over a few years. They measured it over some years. And they found a constant, predictable mathematical relationship. That means that 10 years from now, there will be a higher proportion of C14 to C14. Are you with me? And 10 years ago, there was less. So you know what they did? They predicted the graph backwards. This is an assumption. I'm admitting it readily. It's an assumption. You can't do this either by the same token. But they did it. They predicted the graph backwards to find, at this rate of increase of C14 to C12, where do you get a point in history where there was no C14 around? As if to say, imagine an atmosphere that was put into existence with C12, and cosmic radiation started then manufacturing the C14. You follow me? But are you with me, anybody? So they predicted the rate of increase, or the rate of decrease, backward in time. And you know where it intersected zero? 5,700 years ago. That means that if this assumption is correct, and by the same token, it's only an assumption, because the rate might have increased and decreased, it might have zigzagged, we don't know what it did. But if you want to make an assumption, make the assumption that the evidence shows you. You follow? But they blindly ignore that work. They say, no, we'll assume that 50,000 years ago. You follow me? How you look at the evidence, that's what it is. You look at it one way, it proves one thing. Look at it another way, it proves exactly the opposite. That brings me to the final point, which is this. Much more important than all the scientific inquiry is the following point. And that's this. It boils down to what you want to believe. Do you want to believe all this? Do you want to see it this way? Then you use the same tools. You don't ignore science. It speaks to you. Use the same tools. The Bala Musa says that the way you do it personally is not scientific. The way you do is you simply look at your own life. That's all. What's happened in your life? Tragedies have happened to you? Major events? Major happy events? What was the result? Sometimes people go through things in life that may be, at the time, the blackest things imaginable. But you read where they take you, and you can't believe the result that came out of those things. At the time, but that's a mystical pathway in the world, by the way, that you live through the blackest experiences, and at the end, you'll see not only weren't they black, you'll see the source of the next world was in that pain. That we've discussed this many times mystically before, and we'll go into it again. They say that the way you have to do it is this. It's very, very fascinating. I'll tell you the principle, one or two illustrations, and we'll leave it at that. What you have to do is this. If you look at your life in broken terms, if you look at your own life, what happened today, what happened yesterday, you don't see significance. What happened tomorrow, you don't see significance. When you put it all together, the pathway of all the insignificant events spell a story. You follow me? Even though when you realize where you've ended up, the opportunities that you've been given to end up where you have, from where you began, it's the most amazing experience of Ashkocha, of how you've been guided through life. One great Mashkiach said that the way you have to do it is if you look at your life overall, you'll see nothing, but you have to write a Megillah of your life. What's a Megillah? The Megillah, what he meant was the Megillah of Esther. The Megillah of Esther was a Megillah in which each event was totally meaningless. There was a crazy king who wanted to kill the Jews. He had a minister who wanted to help him. They made a plan, a plot to kill the Jews. There were other things that happened. Esther got married to the king by some amazing coincidence. Remember all this. Two people plotted to get a kill. Mordecai happened to tell him. A whole series of disconnected, tragic events. And suddenly they all intersected at the same point. And at that instant, all the Jews were saved. The enemies were destroyed. And the final redemption, the redemption of the Jews on which we live today, happened. But the only place you see it is when you write the story in a flow. When you look at any event there, Mordechai, what happened, where the people tried to kill the king, Esther marrying the king, Haman wanting to kill the Jews, each event over there is just meaningless, it's a tragedy. But when you write the story, you follow me, even there was no revelation of Hashem's hand. The reason that he chose the Megillah to explain this is because in the Megillah, Hashem's name is not mentioned once. It's the only book of the Bible, of all 24 books of the Jewish canon, in which Hashem's name isn't mentioned once. The word Esther means to hide. The whole Megillah is just a hiding. It only hides Hashem's presence. And how do you see Hashem in the Megillah? When you read it from beginning to end, it's the most amazing story of miracle. You follow me? That's what you have to do with your life. Look at it today, look at it yesterday, the day before. It seems painfully insignificant. But when you spell out the story over many years, you see the significance. I'll tell you one or two examples, and we'll leave it at that. I mentioned one or two of these to you before, some of you on different occasions. I don't know who's heard it, who hasn't. So I'll just share with you one or two personal experiences that illustrate this. And I'm only doing it to try and show you that if you're looking for a proof in your life, the proof is abundantly clear. You have to look, you just have to know how to look. The first one that springs to mind is something that happened when me, personally, my family lost our father this year. My father, Shalom, was nicked this year. And we had the following experience. I've mentioned it to some of you before, and I'll share it with you again. When my father was Nefta, the people who were with him at the end were two doctors. He was a doctor, and there were two doctors attending to him at the time. One was a surgeon, one was a cardiologist. And they were actually with him. They attended to him in his last illness. They were with him at the moment when he was Nefta. And they were the ones who filled out certain forms. It was a complicated business because it happened on Shabbos. They were people who filled out certain forms that were required for legal purposes, and those forms signed him off, in a sense, in certain, also halakhically it was needed, that those people wrote those forms up and they signed it. One of the people was a Dr. Dawson, surgeon, and one was a Dr. Kessel, cardiologist. Those were the people who were with him. A few days later, I and my family, we went through my father's documents, and we found there his medical degrees. We found his medical and surgical degree, and I think his degree in obstetrics, two of his, or his license to practice medicine, and his medicine and surgery degree, which were given to him 55 years ago at Guy's Hospital in London. One was signed by Dr. Dawson, and one was signed by Dr. Castle. Now, in other words, those who signed him out into life in his profession, and those who attended him in the same center. In other words, the writing's there. You just have to know how to read it. You don't know how to read it until you've seen the flow. When you've seen it at the end, and you know how to read information, it's clear as anything. You only have to experience one or two of these things in your life to understand that there's something that's trying to be said to you. How insensitive, how long are you going to be insensitive? You have to wait till the end? You have to wait until it's too late to see the message? If you want to, you see the message all the time. But you're given the choice whether to open yourself to it or whether to block it out. If you open yourself to the experience, I'm not going to take your time with examples of other people, but people, since I've mentioned this sort of thing, people have come up to me and they've told me unbelievable events that happened in their lives. Maybe next week if there's time, we're not going to keep you now. I'll tell you experiences I've had personally with friends, and other people have come to tell me things that are, if you're a statistical man, if you're a betting man or woman, well then, if anything, proves definitely Ashgokha in life. But what it boils down to from a Jewish point of view is simply this. The evidence is clear, the evidence is there. The only thing is, the evidence doesn't force itself on you. The evidence, the rational, intellectual, we're not talking mystically and meditationally and all the other levels that we promised Mr. Shem to deal with. We're talking rationally, coldly, factually. The evidence is there and it speaks loud and clear. The question is, do you want to hear it or don't you? If you don't want to hear it, not only won't you hear it, you'll hear the opposite. If you don't want to hear it, it will speak to you exactly the opposite. How you tune yourself, that's what you hear. But if you tune yourself correctly and you want to hear it and you examine it objectively, you take your own ego out of the way, the evidence is there and the world speaks.